This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR.
Someone in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Edited. Spanish language in the United States.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Someone in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Edited. Guy Fieri.
I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, ideas about the phenomenon of mass collaboration.
Someone in San Marcos. Edited. List of female drummers.
When you put this out there, did you ask the question, all right, who's in charge of this? Who's going to be in charge of this?
Not really. I was in charge of it.
Someone in Athens, Greece. Edited. Visa requirements for Zimbabwean citizens.
In the early days, I used to read every single edit as they came in. I would click and see what someone had done. That only lasted for a very short period of time. It got very...
Someone in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Fast. It was impossible to keep up with everything.
Edited. 2003 to 2004 United States Network television schedule.
So we came up with the arbitration committee, the idea of administration. What are the rules? What can administrators do or not do and so forth? So it really grew very organically.
Someone in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts.
You know, over a long period of time.
Edited. Unemployment.
I'm looking at a Wikipedia recent changes live map right now. And it just so happens that
someone in Birmingham, Alabama.
Your home state edited the list of reportedly haunted locations in the United States.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's very cool. Little things pop up as people are editing.
Yeah.
Someone in.
And the country flashes.
Belgium.
Yeah.
Edited. Dependency theory.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really nice to see it.
Someone in. Tel Aviv.
Tools like this are
Sri Lankan Airlines.
Interesting because they really help
someone in. Chicago.
You feel
edited. American Idol.
The aliveness of the community.
Someone in. West Bend, Wisconsin.
That there's real people out there.
Edited. Joseph McCarthy. Someone in Hyde Park. Edited. List of minor Power Rangers characters. Someone in the United Kingdom. Edited. Of Monsters and Men. Someone in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Edited. Brazil-Canada relations. Someone in. Edited. Someone in. Edited. Someone in. Edited. Someone in.
You know, when I look and find some entry on something incredibly obscure and I realize, gosh, you know, six different people have had major input into this and it's just amazing. And they may have come from Birmingham, Alabama or Birmingham, England, or who knows where.
So that, you may have already figured out, is one of the founders of Wikipedia, Jimmy Wales. And way back in 2004, Jimmy Wales gave a TED Talk explaining his relatively new website.
So Wikipedia is owned by the Wikimedia Foundation, which I founded, a nonprofit organization. And our goal, the core aim of the Wikimedia Foundation, is to get a free encyclopedia to every single person on the planet. And so if you think about what that means...
Now remember, this was Jimmy Wales speaking almost a decade ago. There was no YouTube, Facebook, sort of out there. And Wikipedia, not yet a household name.
So we're doing around 1.4 billion page views monthly. So it's really gotten to be a huge thing. And everything is managed by the volunteers. And the total monthly cost for our bandwidth is about $5,000. And that's essentially our main cost.
Just $5,000 a month in 2004, considerably lower than Wikipedia's current monthly costs of $2.25 million. Back then, Wikipedia had 1.4 billion page views a month. Now, 19 billion a month. And to make it all possible, the engine that actually runs Wikipedia? Collaboration. It cannot work without a group of volunteers, about 80,000 of them, who update the site for free. So why? Why would they do it?
You know, people don't ask the question, why do people play World of Warcraft? How come they don't ask to be paid to do it? And the answer is it's fun. They do it because it's fun. You know, I'm sure people at the end of an 8-hour binge of playing a video game, they think, okay, that was really stupid. I just wasted 8 hours of my life. Usually when people have an 8-hour binge of editing Wikipedia, they think, well, I made the world a little bit better place than it was when I started, so I feel happy about that. That feeling that this is something culturally that will be remembered in 500 years is something that people find very satisfying.
And that might actually be the answer, because what would motivate thousands or even millions of people to contribute hours of their time to collaborate on something for free? That's what we'll explore on the show today, with TED speakers who all depend on that kind of mass participation, and who have to figure out how to channel that mass chaos into order. Now, in the case of Wikipedia, it actually became a big success because of a big mistake.
In the early days, we had the great benefit of no one paying any attention to us. So we were able to have, you know, some bad things happen until we figured out what we had to do about that.
And that day came
when we had a very serious error
in December 2005
about a lovely guy.
John Siegenthaler is a veteran journalist. He's the former editor and publisher of The Tennessean in Nashville, as well as the first editorial page editor for USA Today. He is not, and let us repeat, not in any way connected to the assassinations of John F. Kennedy or his brother Robert. He was somewhat surprised, therefore, when he read his biography on Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia that anyone can write for or edit, which linked him to those murders.
You know, it was a poorly linked article. Probably very, very few people ever saw it. And, you know, on we marched. But then he wrote this scathing editorial in USA Today, which then got picked up by lots of outlets. And it was our first big splash of media coverage.
And Jimmy Wales joins us now on the phone. He's a founder of Wikipedia, and he's with us from his office.
I got dragged on CNN and everywhere else, too. To be yelled at about
I
it.
Do, but that this information about Mr. Siegenthaler is going to be, was copied, we certainly know, onto other websites, and it could be bouncing around there for a long time.
Well, sure. Now,
wow. Yeah, I remember that.
This particular article is under intense attention from all over the world right now because there's been a lot of press coverage and so forth.
And our traffic tripled we're in about 2 months.
The typical case, though, is that by and large, most people are not doing malicious things at Wikipedia.
That was the first time when I really felt we're not just this funny group of people off on the obscure corner of the internet trying to work on a project. We're actually impacting the world. That was the moment when I said, oh, wow, this is really getting to be big.
And it's amazing when you think about how fast things either take off or die on the internet today. It's amazing that Wikipedia had already been around for nearly 4 years at that point. 4 years earlier, in 2001... Jimmy and a group of collaborators were still trying to figure out what they wanted to do on the internet.
I was interested in how programmers were coming together to create all the really great software as volunteers that really runs. Even today, most of the software that runs the internet is open source software that's created not entirely by volunteers, but largely. And I thought, gosh, this kind of collaboration is very interesting. And it's a mode of cultural production that, to me, seemed like it could be expanded to other things. Why just software? And that was really the early beginnings of thinking about what could people come together to do and build online.
But, I mean, you've heard this sort of foundational principle of economic theory, right? That human motivation is driven by incentive, usually financial. And it seems like your whole model just upends that principle, that theory.
Well, I don't think so. And what's interesting is that, yes, of course, if somebody has a view that human beings are only motivated by money, then they're going to have a pretty blinkered view of how humans behave and also a fairly sad life, in my view. And I think that's important to realize that the internet as a tool allows for really brilliant people to do things that they weren't really able to do in the past. One of my favorite examples is to think about the best bloggers. And I think the best bloggers are easily the equal of the best, say, New York Times columnists. That person always existed. 60 years ago, that person existed. And all they could do at that time was be a fabulous person to have over for a dinner party. But now they can gain an audience of, well, maybe only a few thousand people, maybe millions of people. And they enjoy it. And, it is a remarkable shift in the world.
When you gave your talk in 2005, Wikipedia was a completely different thing than it is now.
We have exactly one employee, and that employee is our lead software developer, and he's only been our employee since January 2005. All the other growth before that So the servers are managed by a ragtag band of volunteers. All the editing is done by volunteers. And the way that we're organized is not like any traditional organization you can imagine. People are always asking, well, who's in charge of this or who does that? And the answer is anybody who wants to pitch in. It's a very unusual and chaotic thing. We've got over 90 servers now.
You know, I remember early days looking at a list of the top 100 websites. And I thought, well, if we do a really great job, we might make it into the top 100 or top 50. And now we're number 5. So it's even exceeded my optimism.
First of all, how good is it? Well, it's pretty good. It isn't perfect, but it's much, much better than you would expect given our completely chaotic model. So how do we do this? How do we manage the quality control? How does it work? So there's a few elements, mostly social policies, and some elements of the software. So the biggest and the most important thing is our neutral point of view policy. This is something that I set down from the very beginning as a core principle of the community that's completely not debatable. It's a social concept of cooperation, which basically says anytime there's a controversial issue, Wikipedia itself should not take a stand on the issue. We should merely report on what reputable parties have said about it. So this neutrality policy is really important for us because it empowers a community that is very diverse to come together and actually get some work done. So we have very diverse contributors in terms of political, religious, cultural.
What do you think could be the next big kind of... I mean, what are the potentials out there? What are the possibilities for massive participation and collaboration?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things that are going on. One of the things that I always tell people is, you know, when I started Wikipedia back in 2001, all of the technology to create Wikipedia had already existed for several years. You know, web server, web browser, database, even the idea of wiki was 6 years old when I started Wikipedia. Yet, it didn't start until I started it 6 years later. And so I always say, think of all the technology that we have today that we've had for several years and what could be created with it that nobody's even really thought of yet.
What was the first article put up on Wikipedia?
You know, what's interesting about that is lost to history. So The software originally only kept 5 revisions. I do know the first words in Wikipedia because I wrote them, and that was "Hello World." And that's something that programmers do. When you learn a new language, you always write a program called "Hello World," where you just print out "Hello World." So that's what I did there.
Jimmy Wales. Check out his TED Talk from 2005 at ted.npr.org. Now, you might not edit Wikipedia pages, but trust me, you've participated in another massive-scale online collaboration without even knowing it, and it wouldn't be possible without Beyonce, Gmail, and a lot of frustration. More on that in a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, the chaos and the power of collaboration. What happens when hundreds or millions of people contribute toward a singular goal? Well, there's a good chance, a very good chance, that you've actually been part of a huge online project, unknowingly. But more on that later. First, if you've ever bought a concert ticket online or signed up for Gmail, there's a box that pops up with words that look kind of wavy, and you have to type in what you think those words are.
And the reason is there is to make sure that you, the entity filling out the form, are actually a human and not a computer program that was written to submit the form millions of times.
It's like the most annoying thing ever.
I'm to blame. I'm sorry.
The man to blame is Luis Von Ahn, inventor of CAPTCHAs. I couldn't get tickets to Beyonce this summer because I couldn't figure out the CAPTCHAs.
Did you really want to see her?
Yeah, and she put on another show, two other shows in Washington. They were still sold out.
Yeah, sorry.
So CAPTCHAs are actually designed to prevent automated computer programs from doing things like buying up all those Beyonce tickets because those programs cannot read those squiggly lines, believe it or not, as well as humans can. And so today, every single day, almost 200 million CAPTCHAs are typed into computers around the world.
When I first heard this, well, first I was proud. I thought, look at the impact that my work has had. But then I started feeling bad because not only are they annoying, they're also, each time you type one, you waste about 10 seconds of your time. And if you multiply 200 million by 10 seconds, you get that humanity as a whole is wasting like 500,000 hours every day.
Man, imagine what you could do with those 500,000 hours.
Yeah, so that's exactly what I was thinking about.
Here's Luis's TED Talk.
But then I started thinking, is there any way in which we can use this effort for something that is good for humanity? So, see, here's the thing. While you're typing a CAPTCHA, during those 10 seconds, your brain is doing something amazing. Your brain is doing something that computers cannot yet do. So can we get you to do useful work for those 10 seconds? Another way of putting it is there's some humongous problem that we cannot yet get computers to solve, but that somehow we can split into tiny 10-second chunks such that each time somebody solves a CAPTCHA, they solve a little bit of this problem. And the answer to that is yes, and this is what we're doing now. So what you may not know is that nowadays, while you're typing a CAPTCHA, not only are you authenticating yourself as a human, but in addition, you're actually helping us to digitize books.
And the basic idea is you start with a book.
You've seen those things, right? Like a book? Okay. So you start with a book, and then you scan it.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of
the next step in the process is that the computer needs to be able to decipher all of the words in these pictures.
It was the season of light. It was the best of turns. It was the best of trends. It was the best of dressage.
That, unfortunately, is not very accurate. For older books, the ink has faded, and so the pictures look as if you had taken a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy of some book. So it looks pretty distorted. So computers can't read them very well, but humans can. So what we're doing now is we're taking all of the words that the computer cannot recognize, and we're getting people to read them for us while they type a CAPTCHA on the internet. So next time you type a CAPTCHA, those words that you're typing are words that are coming directly from books that the computer could not recognize, and we're using what you're entering to help digitize the books.
And then that word, what, gets sent back to whoever's digitizing that book, and it sort of automatically fills in that part of the puzzle?
That's exactly right. It puts it back in there, and then that's it. It goes on to the next word.
So, like, more than a billion people have helped digitize books, and they have no idea?
Yeah. That's basically what I work on. That's my work. It's taking things that get done by millions of people and try to reuse or recycle the human mental energy towards something else.
The question that motivates my research is the following. If you look at humanity's large-scale achievements, these really big things that humanity has gotten together and done, like historically, like, for example, building the pyramids of Egypt, or the Panama Canal, or putting a man on the moon, there's a curious fact about them. And it is that they were all done with about the same number of people. It's weird. They were all done with about 100,000 people. And the reason for that is because before the internet, coordinating more than 100,000 people, let alone paying them, was essentially impossible. So the question that motivates my research is, if we can put a man on the moon with 100,000, what can we do with 100 million?
The answer? It's Luis's latest project. It started about 3 years ago. He had just sold his second company to Google.
You know, I retired. I retired for like a day.
I would.
I was going to watch a lot of TV is what I was going to do, but then I got bored.
Which got him thinking about this question.
How can we get 100 million people translating the web into every major language for free? So I would like to translate all of the web, or at least most of the web, into every major language. Okay, so that's...
Why couldn't you just use, language software to do it?
Turns out they're just not very good. You would never see a book translated by Google Translate, for example. Even when it's accurate, you don't even know whether to trust it or not because it's so inaccurate the rest of the time. You know, computers can't yet do this. This is why language translation is such a big business. It's because computers can't do it very well.
And there are other hurdles.
The other problem that you're going to run into is a lack of motivation. How are we going to motivate people to actually translate the web for free? Okay, this is normally, you have to pay people to do this. So how are we going to motivate them to do it for free? Now, when we were starting to think about this...
And so what Luis came up with is a project and website called Duolingo. And here's how it works. You start by learning a language by typing in basic words like girl...
La niña.
Or boy...
Un niño.
But now remember, Luis wanted to harness all that potential human energy into one huge project.
So you learn a language, but while you're learning, you're also helping to translate the web.
Okay, so the way this works is whenever you're just a beginner, we give you very, very simple sentences. There's, of course, a lot of very simple sentences on the web.
Ella es una niña.
We give you very, very simple sentences along with what each word means.
Ella.
She
is una
a
niña.
Girl.
Okay, and as you translate them and as you see how other people translate them, you start learning the language. And as you get more and more advanced, we give you more and more complex sentences to translate.
La mujer come una manzana.
But at all times, you're learning by doing.
Okay, so you get better and better at it, and then you basically give the user like a news article or something, and you ask them to translate it.
Yep, that's the basic idea.
And then how do you know it's accurate?
It's basically multiple people translate the same thing, and it turns out it's really accurate. We've measured, and it's as accurate as a single professional translator.
How fast would it take to translate all of Wikipedia into, say, 5 or 6 or 10 major languages?
It could be done in really a matter of weeks if we were entirely doing just Wikipedia and had enough people. So, for example, if there were 1 million people learning English from Spanish, for example, we could translate it in something like 80 hours.
All of Wikipedia into Spanish?
Well, if there are 1 million people going at it, they can do it quickly.
Do you think that the key to making this work, to getting millions, tens of millions of people to collaborate, to participate, is you have to give them something back?
Yeah, I think so. It's very hard to mobilize 10 million people, 100 million people. I actually think even for nice causes, you won't get 100 million people helping to do it if you just have a good cause. I think in most cases, you have to give something back.
Luis Van Aan. You can find out more about Duolingo and watch Luis's full talk at ted.npr.org. I've put in La Femme, L'Homme many, many times. So I'm pretty sure that I've translated the woman and the man in many French websites.
Yeah, so that actually, you probably weren't doing any useful translation there.
Oh, sorry. I'm just trying to, you know, pitch in a little bit.
Sorry.
I'll fill your capture in, it's not case sensitive. I'm sensitive, so sensitive, so fill my capture in. I'll fill your capture in, it's not case sensitive. I'm sensitive, so...
How do you describe yourself? Because you have a very cool name. You were born to be like a guy talking about the future.
I'm not sure about that.
Somebody named you Clay Shirky.
That is true.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the funny thing is my mother is a reference librarian and said, oh, you should know about this thing we're learning about in library school. It's called the Internet. And this is back in 1992. And I said, okay, Ma, I'll check it out. And that's how I kind of fell down the rabbit hole.
Clay Shirky, as you've probably figured out, writes a lot about the Internet and how technology has helped create this space for mass collaboration. And his TED Talk begins with a story.
The story starts in Kenya in December of 2007 when there was a disputed presidential election. And in the immediate aftermath of that election, and there was an outbreak of ethnic violence. And there was a lawyer in Nairobi, Ori Akola, who began blogging about it on her site, Kenyan Pundit. And Akola solicited from her commenters more information about what was going on, and the comments began pouring in, and she quickly said, it's too much. I can't keep up. There is more information about what's going on in Kenya right now than any one person could manage. If only there was a way to automate this. And two programmers who read her blog held their hands up and said, we could do that. And in 72 hours, they launched Ushahidi. Ushahidi, the name means witness or testimony in Swahili, is a very simple way of taking reports from the field, aggregating it, and putting it on a map. And enough people looked at it and found it valuable enough that the programmers who created Ushahidi decided they were going to make it open source and turn it into a platform. It's since been deployed in Mexico to track electoral fraud. It's been deployed in Washington, D.C. to track snow cleanup. And it's been used most famously in Haiti in the aftermath of the earthquake. This went from a single implementation in East Africa in the beginning of 2008 to a global deployment in less than 3 years.
So in the case of Ori Akola, didn't there have to be some serendipity? I mean, didn't these programmers have to say, we can do this, we can help this?
That's exactly right. There's a very high degree of serendipity there. We live in a world where fortuitous accidents, the likelihood of fortuitous accidents, is maximized, A, by the scale at which our communications network now operates, but B, by the freedom that we all have now to signal, oh, I could help with that. I could come forward and help with that. We just see more acts of serendipity because more of us are visible to more of us, and more of us have more ability to connect the dots for ourselves. That is the resource that I'm talking about. I call it cognitive surplus, and it represents the ability of the world's population to volunteer and to contribute and collaborate on large, sometimes global projects. Cognitive surplus is made up of two things. The first, obviously, is the world's free time and talents. The world has over a trillion hours a year of free time to commit to shared projects. Now, that free time existed in the 20th century, but we didn't get Ushahidi in the 20th century. That's the second half of cognitive surplus. The media landscape in the 20th century was very good at helping people consume, and we got, as a result, very good at consuming. We still like to consume, of course, but it turns out we also like to create and we like to share.
I'm curious about this idea that there's a lot of free time.
Indeed.
Because I don't have any free time.
Well, everyone says that.
And you don't have free time.
That's also not true. Everyone says that, but everyone who ever says that to me, my reply is always the same, which is, you watch no television? When people say they have no free time, what they mean is, my free time is already allocated. The free time of any industrialized nation is awesomely large. People in this country have enough free time to add up to, on average, 30 or 35 hours a week of television watching. And one of the things we're seeing in younger populations is they are starting either by overlapping other kinds of activities while the television is on, or simply moving away from the television, recommitting their time to other things. And sometimes those activities are important and momentous, the creation of Wikipedia, the creation of the Linux operating system, the kind of famous examples. Very often they're just sort of silly things, famously lolcats.
Yeah, I mean, well, we can talk about lolcats all afternoon.
All day long.
Right, lolcats are cute pictures of cats made cuter with the addition of cute captions, and they are also...
Okay, let me just interrupt Clay's talk for a sec, because we want to explain what lolcats are, laugh-out-loud cats. Can we get an idea of what... Carl, can you come in here for a sec? Carl?
You gotta put your headphones on.
Oh, sure, I can do it.
All right, you ready?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay. In the studio with me, Carl Castle, NPR's Carl Castle. Carl, can you read some of these lolcat captions for me?
Sure. Hiken has cheeseburger. I made you a cookie, but I eated it. I love this chair.
Now let us stipulate, as the lawyers say, that lolcats are the stupidest possible creative act.
I love this chair.
But here's the thing. The stupidest possible creative act is still a creative act.
I'm in your couch, stealing your change.
Someone who has done something like this, however mediocre and throwaway, has tried something, has put something forward in public.
Nobody goes until litter box is clean.
The gap is between doing anything and doing nothing. And someone who makes a lolcat has already crossed over that gap.
Well, I tried to hang up your laundry, and that's when I realized I didn't have thumbs.
Carl, thank you. Thanks for that.
Been a pleasure. Enjoyed it.
All right, let's get back to Clay Shirky now.
And what the internet has essentially helped us rediscover is that there are all of these non-financial motivations that we all have, the desire to have a sense of autonomy or competence. I'm doing this by myself, or I'm on my own. I'm good at making lolcats, or I'm good at updating Wikipedia. I'm part of a group that knows I'm here. I'm feeling a sense of membership, or I'm being generous to other people in my group. I got appreciation. I got thanks. You can build enormous, enormous things on that collection of intrinsic motivations once you get away from the idea of everybody is, you know, essentially optimizing for time and money and nothing else.
Isn't some of the collaboration like the lolcats thing, though? I mean, isn't that just kind of motivated by ego?
Sure. Oh, no. It's to be able to say that, you know, I am motivated by competence is a fairly dry psychological statement. But what it really means is I am showing you how awesome I am. Ditto a sense of generosity. Many acts of generosity are about me showing you that I have the kind of resources, whether they are mental resources or, you know, people who fund meetup groups or what have you, where I'm actually getting myself some gratitude out of being the guy who's good enough to help you out. So these motivations are not pure. They're just different from I'm doing this because my boss said I had to, or I'm doing this because it's piecework and I get paid.
So wait, why are people willing to do these things and not get paid.
So a lot of people, in looking at things like YouTube or people posting stuff all over Twitter, all over Facebook, are asking themselves, why are these people working for free?
Mm.
And if you ask the question that way, you literally can't understand their behavior. It's when you say, you know what, I'm going to remove money from the equation and I'm going to ask myself, why are these people doing things together? If you go out on any, you know, any street on a spring day in an American city, you can see people gathering together in bars. Nobody says, my God, why are those people going to the bars when the beer is more expensive than if you just drank it at home alone? Right? We all recognize that there are these non-financial motivations that get us out and into groups.
There are a trillion hours a year of participatory value up for grabs. That will be true year in and year out. The number of people who are going to be able to participate in these kinds of projects is going to grow. What's going to make the difference here is what Dean Kamen said, the inventor and entrepreneur. Kamen said, free cultures get what they celebrate. We've got this trillion hours a year. We can use it to crack each other up, and we're going to do that. That we get for free. But we can also celebrate and support and reward the people trying to use cognitive surplus to create civic value. And to the degree we're going to do that, to the degree that we're able to do that, we'll be able to change society. Thank you very much.
Clay Shirky. His latest book is called Cognitive Surplus. You can watch his entire talk at ted.npr.org. On the show today, turning chaos into collaboration, and as we'll hear in a moment, can you OD on collaboration? Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on today's show, ideas about the phenomenon of mass collaboration. And we've been talking mostly about online collaboration, massive projects with hundreds, even millions of people participating. But what about the kind of collaboration that goes on at work every single day?
My name is Jason Fried. I'm from 37 Signals here in Chicago.
Jason's company makes software that helps people collaborate.
Our most popular product is called Basecamp, which is a collaboration tool that millions of people around the world use to get all sorts of different kind of projects done online.
And he loves collaboration. It's what he peddles, except sometimes he hates it.
There's certainly a thing such as over-collaboration, and I believe most companies have that disease.
And in his TED Talk, Jason asks a simple question. Why can't people seem to get work done at work?
We have companies and nonprofits that have employees or volunteers of some sort. And so what they typically do is they decide that all these people need to come together in one place to do that work. They build offices, and they expect their employees or their volunteers to come to that location every day to do great work. However, if you actually talk to people, if you ask people the question, where do you really need to go when you need to get something done, you'll find out that people don't say what businesses think they would say. I'll hear things like the basement, the coffee shop, the library, the train, a plane, and then you'll hear people say, well, it doesn't really matter where I am as long as it's really early in the morning or really late at night or on the weekends. You almost never hear someone say the office, but businesses are spending all this money on this place called the office and they're making people go to it all the time, yet people don't do work in the office. What is that about? This is what happens. It's like the front door of the office is like a Cuisinart. And you walk in and your day is shredded to bits because you have 15 minutes here and 30 minutes there and then something else happens and you're pulled off your work and you got to do something else and you have 20 minutes, then it's lunch, then you have something else to do. Before you know it, it's like it's 5 p.m., right? I got nothing done today. I was at work. I went to these meetings. I did these conference calls. I did all this stuff, but I didn't actually do anything. And even though the workday is typically 8 hours, how many people here have ever had 8 hours to themselves at the office? How about 7 hours? Six? Five? Four? When's the last time you had 3 hours to yourself at the office? 2 hours? One, maybe?
If people don't have time to think, and thinking time needs to be your own time, then they have a really hard time actually producing great work.
So when you think about collaboration, you think, especially with what you do, right, in the tech world, it's like there's a room full of pizza boxes, you know, basketball hoops over the trash cans, and unwashed young people just like making it happen.
I mean, that's the picture of it. But that's more of a just a brainstorm sort of thing, which is fine and healthy and good. But the real work doesn't get done in those rooms. That's not what collaboration is all about. Real great work gets done when people leave those rooms and they get to work and they think and they have uninterrupted time.
So what are these interruptions that happen at the office that don't happen in other places? The real problems are what I like to call the M&Ms, the managers and the meetings. Those are the real problems in the modern office today. And this is why things don't get done at work. And managers are basically people whose job it is to interrupt people. That's pretty much what managers are for. They're for interrupting people. They don't really do the work, so they have to make sure everyone else is doing the work, which is an interruption. But what's even worse is the thing that managers do most of all, which is call meetings. And meetings are just toxic, terrible, poisonous things during the day at work. We all know this to be
true.
Talk
to me about meetings.
Do I have to?
Yeah.
I don't like them, mostly. Meetings have turned into the first resort, and that's what I have a problem with. It is valuable to get people around a table face-to-face and hash things out from time to time. But in most businesses, there's an overabundance of meetings. They happen far too often, and it becomes the only way to deal with any decision. So we always use them as a last resort, and we're always trying to find our own time to get back to each other when we're ready to get back to each other instead of saying we're all ready at the same exact time.
Okay, Jason, let's be honest here. Our whole show today has been about collaboration as a positive thing. And we see that word, collaboration. And, you know, sort of angels and fairies are sort of floating in our brains. It's a good thing. Is it a good thing always?
Well, collaboration is good, but we shouldn't mistake it for interruption. When you think about collaboration, you think about people tapping each other on the shoulder and riffing on ideas and bouncing back and forth. But
I'm thinking about Lennon McCartney, you know, sitting in a room, strumming guitars, throwing back lyrics.
Yeah, that works too. if you're that lucky to be that great. And I bet those folks way back when, they had a lot of time to themselves to just write lyrics or play guitar. And that's where a lot of the ideas ultimately came from.
See, I wonder, could you have too much collaboration that it just kills all the great ideas?
Yes. There is certainly a point where there's too many ideas, too many thoughts. At that point, people just want to be heard. And then you're not really solving these problems anymore. Then you're just sort of playing politics. And that doesn't really get anything done.
So I have some suggestions to kind of remedy the situation. We've all heard of like casual Friday thing. How about no talk Thursdays? How about just one Thursday once a month? And cut that day in half and just say the afternoon. I'll make it really easy for you. So just silence. That's it. And what you'll find is that a tremendous amount of work actually gets done when no one talks to each other. Another thing you can try is switching from face-to-face stuff, having meetings, and replace that with email and instant messaging. And then you can be interrupted when you're available. If you do have a meeting coming up, if you have the power, just cancel it. Just cancel that next meeting. Now, I don't mean like move it. I mean just erase it from memory. It's gone. And you'll find out that everything will be just fine.
Earlier in the show, we talked to Jimmy Wales from Wikipedia. And I mean, that's sort of held up as the ultimate example of online collaboration that created this incredible resource. And yet that couldn't have happened without all these people being involved and fixing each other's mistakes and improving each other's work.
But think about how Wikipedia came together. Very few people who contribute to Wikipedia know each other. They're not in the same physical location. They contributed to Wikipedia on their own schedule. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why it's great. If you had all the Wikipedia authors together in one office,
oh, that would be a
Wikipedia
nightmare.
Would not be as great.
That would not be a pleasant room.
No.
Very unpleasant.
And we would all suffer because Wikipedia would not be as great.
That's Jason Fried. He's the co-founder and president of the software company 37 Signals. And you can see his full talk at ted.npr.org. So we're talking about collaboration on the show today. And this next story is about a group called Code for America. You don't have to tell everybody. Just between us, did you ape that from Teach for America?
Oh, yeah, I tell everybody that.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the whole beginning of it was we were talking about Teach for America, and we were like, it could be like a code for America. And that just stuck.
That's Code for America's founder, Jennifer Palka. And if you know Teach for America, it recruits young teachers to teach in cities where they're needed most. Well, Code for America does the same kind of thing for the tech world.
So the other thing we call it is a Peace Corps for geeks.
Peace Corps for geeks?
Here's her TED Talk.
We select a few fellows every year, and we have them work with city governments. Instead of sending them off into the third world, we send them into the wilds of City Hall. And there they make great apps, they work with city staffers, but really what they're doing is they're showing what's possible with technology today.
You know, everyone's got their story of frustration at the first one you always hear is like the DMV. It's also getting better in some places, and people don't recognize that it isn't stuck, you know, in 1985.
It's moved to like 1987.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you can do it by mail now often you can do it online. But I think,
you know, a lot of people have given up on government. And if you're one of those people, I would ask that you reconsider, because things are changing. Politics is not changing. Government is changing. And because government ultimately derives its power from us, remember, we the people, how we think about it is going to affect how that change happens.
And so in 2011, in Boston, as happens so often in government, the city had a problem everyone knew about, but nobody could solve.
And Jonathan, people there really hit the jackpot.
Well, it's one of those jackpots they hit, Jack, that nobody seems to want to celebrate. 24 inches in our area, they'll be working through the night here.
This was the snowpocalypse that hit the East Coast in 2011. 2 feet of snow dropped in Boston. The problem?
That much snow that needs to get shoved out of the way, you create not just snow piles, you create small snow hills like the one here I'm standing on.
And we arrived, and there was just a massive snowstorm, I think, the night after we got there. And the whole city was shut down.
That's Eric Michaels Ober.
And I was a 2011 Code for America fellow.
One of Jennifer Palka's Peace Corps geeks. So, Snowpocalypse 2011, Eric shows up to City Hall.
Where they were discussing the fact that when they plow the streets, fire hydrants that already had a bunch of snow in them were actually completely covered, sometimes in mounds and mounds of snow. And
it was a problem that they had and wanted to do something about.
So Eric, the programmer, he did the math, and in Boston, there are
13,000 fire hydrants across the city, and they actually already had the data set. You know, they'd gone around the city with GPS and said, okay, here's the fire hydrant, here's the fire hydrant, here's the fire
so
hydrant.
So Eric sat down at his computer, hydrant, and he wrote some code.
So it's a pretty simple app. I mean, I think I built the first version of it in a weekend.
It was an app that worked with Google Maps, where you could see every single fire hydrant on a map. And then if you live near one, you could volunteer to shovel it out when it snowed. It's called Adopt a Hydrant. So let me ask you about Al. Who was Al?
Al was the first fire hydrant that was adopted in 2011.
So when you adopt your fire hydrant, you get to name it. You agree to dig it out when it snows. And if you don't, somebody can steal it from you. So it's like a game. And hundreds of people in Boston signed up.
8 months later, this one guy, Forrest Frizzell, who was the deputy IT director for the city and county of Honolulu.
Hi, Forrest.
Aloha, yep.
That's Forrest.
I remember seeing Adopt a Hydrant, and I was like, wow, that's a really great idea. And so I was like, hey, you know, can we reuse that code?
And everyone was like, I'm not sure I see the relevance.
Like, well, you don't really have to worry about snow in Honolulu.
And Forrest said, no, we have a problem with tsunami sirens.
Problems with them being vandalized. Primarily, the batteries were being stolen out of them.
And so Forrest thought, well, what if you could adopt a tsunami siren? Like, if you're out on the beach and you're
walking your dog, or you're going on your morning jog or whatever, and you notice that, you know, it's been tampered with.
You could just notify the city through the app. And then when the sirens get tested each month,
they'll actually send you an email alerting you and say, hey, be prepared.
You know, you just listen up. You make sure everything's working. So Forrest built that app, and it worked. Out of hundreds of sirens in Honolulu,
the adoption rate is about 75%.
Now, you can imagine the potential here, because the way the code is written, there's a folder with a file in it, and that file contains the word hydrant, and all you have to do is change that word to sidewalk or storm drain or tsunami siren. And Jennifer Polka says a lot of cities are trying this.
Everything that works on the internet depends on a lot of people collaborating, but there's also these rules that you see across all the really successful platforms. Many, many, many more people consume the information or benefit from the information than actually contribute the information. But I think the goal really is that we can get more and more people involved. Some of them will be very, very lightweight involvement. Some people will download an app and only ever report one or two issues to city government, for instance. Some people become power users. And in the end, all those things together add up to something that's really different from what went before and truly adding value to the functioning of the city.
I mean, the question you ask is, how do we architect the systems in the right way? How do you do that?
I don't think anybody knows yet. I think that a big agenda for this decade is going to be experimenting with that and finding more ways that we can do it and do it at scale. Because, you know, if you look at the history of the internet over the past, 15 years, it would have been very hard to predict what was going to work. But because there were so many experiments happening, some of them hit big. And that's how you get something like Wikipedia that is, been transformational. But I think if, before Wikipedia existed, if you'd gone and told people, we're going to do this thing and everyone's going to contribute, a lot of people would said, good luck. But it works. And it works because of a certain kind of chemistry. And I think these undervalued resources that aren't apparent in our current institutional models that start to show themselves. And if you can keep playing with that and keep finding ways that people really will work together, you have something very powerful.
Here's more from Jennifer's TED Talk.
So an app that takes, a couple of days to write and then spreads virally, that's sort of a shot across the bow to the institution of government. It suggests how government could work better. Not more like a private company, as many people think it should, and not even more like a tech company, but more like the internet itself. And that means permissionless, it means open, it means generative. It's not just Code for America fellows. There are hundreds of people all over the country that are standing and writing civic apps every day in their own communities. They haven't given up on government. They are frustrated as hell with it, but they're not complaining about it. They're fixing it. And these folks know something that we've lost sight of. They don't care as much about using their voices. They're using their hands. They're using their hands to write applications that make government work better. And those applications let us use our hands to make our communities better. That could be shoveling out a hydrant, pulling a weed. And certainly, we could have been shoveling out those fire hydrants all along, and many people do. But these apps are like little digital reminders that we're not just consumers, and we're not just consumers of government putting in our taxes and getting back services. We're more than that. We're citizens. So the question I have for all of you here, when it comes to the big, important things that we need to do together, all of us together, are we just going to be a crowd of voices, or are we also going to be a crowd of hands? Thank you.
Jennifer Polka. She's taking a temporary break from Code for America. She's now a top tech advisor to the White House.
1, 2, 3, 4. Can I have just a little more? 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I love you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com, and you can download and subscribe to this program through iTunes or the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Sanaz Meshkinpour, and Neva Grant. with help this week from A.D. Quigg, Portia Robertson-Migas, and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.